Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. A kind of rainy day, wonderful day to sit and listen to the radio. We have a most interesting interview for you today. Most interesting. Jerry Yellen, an author of the one we're going to talk about mostly is The Blackened Canteen, and it's the title of it, you know, you just wonder, what in the world is he talking about?
Jerry, of course, for many of our audience members know as a former resident, longtime resident of Fairfield, and one of the original founders of Lisco, the local internet service company.
Wow.
Yeah. And Jerry's joining us today from Vero Beach, Florida. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, it's nice and hot down here, 86 degrees and lots of humidity and water on the ground.
Well, it's wet here, too, but it's certainly not 86 degrees.
No.
Don't have any changing leaves, Monica.
Oh, yeah. Gorgeous.
It's starting to get pretty.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're maybe a little homesick for Fairfield.
I am. Homesick for Fairfield. That's really home.
Yeah. It's home for a lot of us.
That's where I found myself.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
We moved there in, 16, 17 years ago, and I was going through a tough time, and I connected with Jerry Yellen when I started to do the Cities program.
Well, that's a pretty amazing recommendation. And I'm guessing that your creative endeavors are a result, have some connection with that, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. The freedom to look at yourself, you know, you learn more writing than you do reading, and you learn more about yourself when you write, and that's what happened to me, and it's been a great experience.
Well, Jerry, let's talk a little bit about how you came to write your first book of War and Weddings.
Well, in 1983, I had almost four years of service in the military, and I made the invasion of Iwo Jima, and we landed on Iwo Jima March 7th, 1945, and strafed for the Marines. And war is not a pretty thing when you see it on the ground, and I saw the remnants of 28,000 young people who were killed on 8 square miles of land. You couldn't escape it anywhere that you were. And there were 21,000 Japanese killed. They weren't Japanese to me. They were not people. And 7,000 Marines. I came home in 1945, the end of 1945, wandered around, didn't have any direction, kind of was lost, but nobody knew about post-traumatic stress at the time, and got married in 1949. By 1983, we'd been married quite a number of years. We had four grown children, and I was invited to go to Japan to speak. And we thought it was a wonderful place. It blew me away. I never saw the Japanese as people until I went there. And on the last night that we were in Japan, Helene, my wife, will be married 59 years this Wednesday.
Oh, my goodness.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
And we met on a blind date in 1949. So.
All right.
So Helene said that Robert, our youngest son, would like Japan. And we came home and we offered him a trip, which he took. Came back, graduated from San Diego State, didn't know what to do. So in 1984, he signed a one-year contract to teach English in Japan. And now it's 2008, 24 years later, he hasn't come back yet. He got married in 1988, and we went to the wedding, came home from the wedding, and of all of the years, I was 63 years old then, of all 64 years old, in all of the years that we'd been married and had grown children, no one had ever heard a war story from me. Nobody had, I'd never spoken about it. All that they knew was that I was a fighter pilot and that I flew over Japan. When I came home from the wedding, I felt it was time for me to talk and tell them a little bit about my experiences. So I sat down and I put down about 30 pages of my wartime experiences. And I gave it to a man who worked for San Diego Magazine, who was a friend of Robert's, who was a writer, and he edited it. It was published in December of 1988. They were married in March of 88, so it was published in December of 88 and voted the best feature article in a magazine by the San Diego Press Club. Some people asked me to expand it. It was an interesting story to make it into a book. So in 1989, 1990, I wrote the book. I sent it to every major publisher and got rejections. And it lingered in Microsoft Word as a book. When we moved to Fairfield, I told the story to Rodney Charles and Ed Spinella, and they took the book and published it in 1995. The title came from what I spoke about at the wedding. Japanese weddings are about making speeches, and I made the last speech. And I spoke of war, and I spoke of weddings. So that's where the title came from.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realized that wasn't the only book that you had in you.
No, I've written several books, but they're still they're still in form. I started a book before this one of Warren Wedding was published, called Grandpa, and it's what I envision my grandchildren to be as adults in the world that they live in. So that's an ongoing project for years after years after years. I've also written a book called The Letter, that will probably be published after this, the Black and Canteen gets going a little bit.
Well, Caroline, why don't you read what's on the back cover of the Black and Canteen?
Okay, this one from Lucy Toll Spence. She says, "Words cannot express the true feelings of the heart when reading the Black and Canteen. We are brought to tears with the realization that this author cared enough to honor these fallen heroes of World War II. This fictional account has been faithfully told based on the facts of these soldiers' lives. What a true blessing." And that's a very apt description of this book.
So, Jerry, this book is written as a fictionalized version of a true events, correct?
Well, there are 8 people that I know, or I learned about, 5 Americans and 3 Japanese people that are the featured characters in the book. And the 4 Americans who died in the crash of 2 B-29s, Jack O'Connor, Newton Tao, well, that lady was 3 years old when her father, Newton Tao, was killed in a mid-air collision on June 20th, 1945. So Newton Tao's in the book. Monroe Cohn's in the book. And a man by the name of Ken Colley is in the book. They're real people. I cognize the lives using my own life as a 17-year-old in 1941, before Pearl Harbor, as a guideline for Jack O'Connor and what the men went through in flying school when I went through flying school.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to write the book in July of 2006, after I came home from a ceremony honoring these men who were killed, a ceremony conducted every year on top of Mount Shizuhatu in Shizuoka, Japan, where Mr. Ito, one of the Japanese characters, erected a monument that says B-29 on it, and then the story is told in Japanese. Those who are interested in seeing the video can see it at my website, jerryellen.com. There's a 3-minute video of the ceremony. It's a very interesting ceremony. So I started to write about Jack O'Connor. He was the first one, because I received a historian from one of the bomber groups about George O'Connor, who was the brother of Jack O'Connor, who was killed. And I cognized Jack O'Connor as a graduate of high school, a really good baseball player, whose mother wanted him to go to Fordham. And I sent the first loops of pages to George O'Connor Jr., who was a 50-ish-year-old attorney in Washington, D.C. And he said, how did you know my uncle was a baseball player? I said, I didn't know. He says, how did you know about Fordham? I went and graduated from Fordham Law School. So I had...
Well, so you had the basic facts of his life correct before you actually had talked to
his family? Before I actually wrote, you know, I had written just a few paragraphs, a few pages.
Wow.
And I cognized that. And then I wrote about Newton Towle because I spoke to his daughter, I spoke to his grandson. I wrote about Ken Colley before I spoke to his two surviving nephews, one named Ken Colley, one named John Colley, still living in Windsor Locks, where Connecticut, where they came from. And I knew nothing about Monroe Cone. I couldn't find any information about Monroe Cone. So those are the four guys that were killed that are live characters in the book until June 20th, 1945, when they're killed. And then I was fascinated by a story told me by one of the Japanese men, Dr. Sugano, who was 12 years old in 1945 when the bombing happened, about a man by the name of Richard Fisk and a man by the name of Takeshi Maeda. Richard Fisk was a 19-year-old bugler on the West Virginia when it was sunk at Pearl Harbor. And Takeshi Maeda, the Japanese man, whom I met and know and really like as a human being, dropped one of the torpedoes that sunk the West Virginia. And the story of their meeting, Fisk and Maeda, is told in the book, which is a true story. And then there's Mr. Ito, who, the other Japanese person, who buried the Americans alongside the Japanese and erected a monument and has started conducting a ceremony for the dead Americans in 1946.
And he's really the reason that you know about this story at all, correct?
No, that's really not the way it happened, Monica. I did a documentary for Japanese National Television, NHK, in March of 2005. It was a memorial service for 100,000 Japanese that were killed in a bombing raid, March 10th, 1945, over Tokyo. And I was asked, why was I in Japan, and why did I feel that there has to be healing between America and Japan, and you continue to do that? And I responded that after my son's wedding, I had nightmares for weeks that my Japanese grandchildren were flying across the Pacific and bombing Japan, bombing America, and my American grandchildren were flying across the Pacific to bomb Japan, and I just couldn't let that happen. Well, Mr. Sugano, Dr. Sugano, heard that interview, saw me on television, and it resonated with him because he has a daughter who married a West Point graduate, an American. And he has American grandchildren and Japanese grandchildren. So he got in touch with Robert, my son in Japan, and invited him to the ceremony in 2005. Robert went, and then I received an invitation to go in 2006. And that's how it started.
Well, what I meant was that Dr. Ito's beginning, the fact that he created this ceremony and kept it up all the time,
is why the story is remembered. That story is in the book.
Yeah, and that's
what he did and how Dr. Sugano met him.
And that's an amazing, it was an amazing thing that he did in the middle of war.
It was more than an amazing thing. I made a speech. I could read parts of the speech, but I don't know how much time we're going to have. But in that speech, my opening lines, and the publisher, Rodney Charles, felt that that was worth putting on the cover of the book. And it says, those who perform acts of kindness without expectation of reward receive the greatest reward of all, immortality. And Mr. Ito did that. He did an act of kindness above and beyond. He has achieved a status in my mind. of how I've tried to conduct my life by doing things, good things, and not talking about it. So he's just a hero to me and a lot of other people, including people from the Japanese, the American side, whose families were killed. And now, what prompted me to tell the story is the story itself. It's just an amazing story. We live in an era now where it isn't much different than 1941 economically, and wars going on. And unfortunately, we had a Secretary of State, which is also in the book, Cordell Hull, who negated an opportunity to meet with Prince Konoye, who was the Prime Minister of Japan, and have Mr. Roosevelt meet with the Prime Minister of Japan, and willing to negotiate a peace, because a war was just imminent in 1941. But Cordell Hull insisted on preconditions before negotiating. Well, like anybody who's negotiating, if you put down the preconditions, then there's no negotiations, because everybody's got everything that everybody wants to talk about. America was disturbed, very disturbed, in 1939, 40, 41, about Japan. The war in China that they started in 1937 when I was 13 years old, the invasion of Indochina, and becoming an ally with Germany. So those were the conditions that Prince Konoye and Emperor Hirohito and all of the major domos in Japan talked about in 1941, and they were prepared to do all of those things, but that's what Cordell Hull wanted to know in advance. So Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. They had, from their side, no choice.
It sounds like you've personally come a long way on the road to forgiveness.
Well, I have a Japanese family. I have three grandchildren. My oldest grandson is 19. He's in the MIT of Japan, Hokkaido University. I have a 17-year-old boy who's a junior in high school in the International Baccalaureate Program. And I have a 12-year-old granddaughter. When Robert told me he was going to get married, I saw the faces of 16 guys that I personally flew with, three of them who were on my wing when they got killed. And I wondered what they would think of this. Mm-hmm. But it was his life, Robert's life, that was important, not my life. And Japanese weddings are about families getting married. And right after Robert's wedding, Takako's father, Taro Yamakawa, and I went to a ryokan, a Japanese inn. We sat with a translator for 3 hours. I didn't speak Japanese, he didn't speak English. And we spoke from our heart, both of us, about education, about religion, about family, about history, about the war, about what we did in the war. And when we were finished talking, when we were finished with the bath, when there was a dead silence, we got out of this huge tub, and he turned to the translator and said in Japanese, "I never knew that there were other people in the world, other than the Japanese, that thought the same way that I thought." And when that was told to me, Japan and the Japanese people became my family.
Wow. Yeah.
That's in the first book.
That's in the first book. Well, in the second book, in the Blackened Canteen, when this, you know, you do a really good job of, like Mom, like Caroline was telling me earlier, of making us feel like we're right there in the action. Mm-hmm. And and there's a lot of actual, you know,
there's a lot of
battle
action
here.
Yeah, right.
But there's a lot going on. For example, we thought Americans, I never thought the Japanese were human beings, period. I sat in my P-51 at 26,000 feet on April 7th, 1945, and I watched 125 bombers drop firebombs into a square of fire so that the whole square was burning. It didn't occur to me one time, not once, that there were people on the ground. There were human beings on the ground. Wow. And they felt the same way about us. You have to demean your enemy or you can't kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Can't think about it. So it's a transformation of thought. We hated the Russians. I never met any. I'm one or two generations away from being a Ukraine, from being in the Russian domination. And I don't know any Russian people, but this country of America for 35 years thought the Russians were going to nuke us and there was going to be war back and forth. But if you meet the people, you find that they're just human beings. They want the same things that I want. 3 square meals a day, something to do, and someone to love. It's humanity that's the same. It's the governments that make war.
Does this remind you of your theme song, Mom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Her favorite, like, it's our family song. It's a Finnish song. What's the title of it?
Well, it's Finlandia.
Finlandia.
This is my song, the song of all the nations. Yeah.
And it talks about how, you know, the commonality.
Yes, yeah, skies are blue everywhere. Flowers are blooming everywhere. And, yeah.
And everyone wants what's best for their family.
Monica, yeah. when I was invited by Virginia Brose, who was a teacher of the year in Iowa, eighth grade teacher, writing teacher and English teacher, to come into middle school in Fairfield in 1995 or 1996 after the book came out, I didn't know what I was going to talk about. I didn't want to talk about war. And it struck me very strongly, whether you're a creationist or evolutionist, it doesn't make any difference. The intelligence of nature in every cell in my body is exactly the same as the intelligence of nature in every other human being, both born, living, and dead. Mm-hmm. So that I can donate my blood to a Japanese person. It doesn't have to speak the language. Have to be the same color. It knows exactly what to do. So when I talk,
that's right.
I tell the story, and I just told that story to 65 teachers this morning in a teacher's workshop, and they got it. We, as human beings, we divide ourselves. We divide ourselves racially, economically, nationally, religiously. We divide ourselves, but we're all the same in the eyes of nature. I don't know. Nobody tells them that they go to sleep when they're awake. Nobody tells them not to eat when they're hungry. And it's we're universalists. If you become a universalist, then you can understand that we're all the same. And then maybe you'll have peace. When I signed this new book, The Blackened Canteen, underneath my signature, I put 3 words: unity - harmony - peace. If we can find a way to live in unity with humanity, in harmony with nature, we can have the ultimate, which is peace in the world.
Yep. Well, I Virginia Brose, her husband Bill, I taught with him when I first started my teaching career at Fairfield High School. He was an English teacher in the high school.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I had a Sister Cities program when I was in Iowa, and I arranged a trip, and Virginia wanted to go. Bill said go, but Frank Brose was 15 years old. He was a sophomore in high school, and she couldn't leave him alone, so I said, take Frank. And Virginia said, well, he doesn't want to go. So I said, well, let him take a friend. And the friend happened to be a girl.
Uh-huh.
And the girl was named... was Kimberly. I don't, you know, she was in high school. She was a year ahead of him. Well, the trip that Frank, they're now married, by the way, live in San Francisco, happily. But this is what happened with Kimberly Brose because she went to Japan. And I'm going to read what she wrote in Amazon.com about the Blackened Canteen. It says, a novel with significant academic value, ! By Kimberly Brose. I have read many academic and historical fiction texts about Japanese history as a longtime student of the subject. Rarely have I found historical fiction to have as many history lessons as in The Blackened Canteen. Yellen does an excellent job of providing not only the experiences of Japanese and Americans in World War II, but also factual historical perspective. The characters in the Blackened Canteen aren't simply sympathetic figures in an historically significant story. Their thoughts also provide insightful analysis of the events that shaped the war in the Pacific. Yellen's descriptions of American airmen's thoughts are particularly credible because of the author's personal experience as the pilot of the B-51. His descriptions of the Japanese civilians' thoughts may provide an even deeper perspective on the thinking of an American World War II veteran. I would recommend this book to students of Japanese history. I have an MA from Washington University in St. Louis in Japanese history and foreign policy, and in my entire study, I never came across a book so entertaining and informative at the same time. I would also recommend this book to anyone looking for an interesting book for their book club. The book invites discussion! It is rare that a book about war ends up being so inspiring.
Well, that she's right on the money.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Jerry Yellen, author of The Blackened Canteen. Jerry, where did this title come from?
In the wreckage of the two B-29s, there was everybody carried canteens. Everybody in the military carried. That's where you got your water. There was a scarred, blackened canteen, blackened by a fire, with a handprint of the person that was holding it in his left hand. And Mr. Ito took that canteen and took as much of the black off as he possibly could and used it in the very first ceremony by pouring sake over the memorial tablets that he created. It's somewhat of a religious performance of using a vessel of some kind to pour something onto something. And when you hold that with your left hand, you're holding the fingerprint. Your hand goes right into the indentations caused by the intense fire on that blackened canteen. There's no better title than that, than The Blackened Canteen.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. How do fire bombs differ from other bombs? I mean, I know that the British firebombed Dresden in the Second World War, and then, of course, this firebombing. But how do they differ?
How do they differ?
Mm-hmm.
Well, England started the firebombing.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese started the just the indiscriminate bombing, as far as Americans were concerned. The first weapon of mass destruction was a rock.
Yeah.
And somebody who threw that rock and hit somebody else had the ability to take what he wanted from that person. And when we were firebombing Japan, we had 12 people in a bomber, and we send over 1,000 bombers. That's 12,000 people at risk, and dropping hundreds of thousands of tons of firebombs. And the next iteration of the weapon of the advancement of the rock with the atomic bomb. And I personally don't see any difference between sending 1,000 bombers over with tonnage or one bomber over with the equivalent tonnage. We're just trying to do what the prime purpose of war is, which is to kill your enemy. And everybody's your enemy, whether you're civilian or you're Japanese. They're the enemy. That's the way war is structured. And it saved my life. There's no question about it. Because I was going to be on the invasion, we expected a million casualties, American casualties. Every Japanese in Japan from 10 years up was taught how to destroy Americans. I was at a briefing about Olympic, which was the name of the invasion, and we were told that there were 1,200 airplanes that the Japanese had left. After the war, it was discovered they had 12,000.
Wow.
They were going to send 300 kamikaze planes an hour for 48 hours at the invasion ships and troops, and the atomic bomb saved all of that. It's a terrible thing to think about it, but it's just more efficient. We had a crew of 12 people on the atomic bomb on the Enola Gay rather than 12,000. It's evolution. For me and for every military general, for every military person, they are taught that your job is to kill the enemy. And to me, the pure purpose of war is to kill your enemy. To me, the pure purpose of life, which I've learned now close to 85 years old, is to connect with all of humanity and all of nature and everything around us. And they're diametrically opposed, the purpose of war. And it you know, interestingly enough, we're going through some political stuff today, and one candidate says we're not going to leave Iraq until we win. And based on what the generals know, there is no winning in Iraq because there's no enemy that can negotiate a peace. We're fighting not a country and not a people. We're fighting an ideology, and we can't win an ideology. From the time of the Christian invasion of Afghanistan, nobody has ever conquered Afghanistan, and Iraq is just a new nation, you know, created in World War I. So we're in a terrible situation, still learning to kill people because we have something that we want to prove. And I'm not negating the fact that we're there. We have to support the troops. We have to do all of that. I'm just talking about the generalities of war.
From your own personal experience.
From my own experience.
Yeah.
Who would have ever thought that my grandchildren would be three of them in Japan and three of them in America? And I had a pre-dream of that. You know, there were no grandchildren in my family other than I had one grandson, but he in America when I had that nightmare.
Wow. Well, Jerry, why don't you read a section from the Blackened Canteen from a side? You talked about possibly reading the speech that you gave.
What I'd like to do is I'd like to read just a little bit to introduce you to the characters.
Okay, great.
Is that all right?
That sounds perfect.
Okay. June 1941. Jack O'Connor bounded down the front stairs of his Bronx apartment house, glanced at the traffic, and started to run along the sidewalk before he crossed the busy street. He ran because he loved to run, an athletic 18-year-old with floppy brown hair and energy to burn. It felt good to be in full stride, racing past the street scene he loved on a June afternoon. He nearly hit Joey Middleman, a classmate at DeWitt Clinton High, who was loading bread into a delivery truck in front of his father's bakery. "Where you heading, Irish?" Joey called out as Jack swept past him. "The Yankees," Jack called back as he entered the subway station and huddled down the stairs two at a time. He flashed his school pass at the guard and raced toward the waiting train, barely squeezing through the closing train doors. The car of the express train to New York was nearly empty as Jack took his seat, reached into the small bag he had been carrying, and removed his baseball glove, unwrapped the string that was holding it tightly around a baseball, put it on, and started pounding the ball into the mitt. A man in a dark suit sitting on the bench across from him lowered his paper, smiled, and said, "New gloves, son?" Jack smiled and replied, "Yep." "You the pitcher from DeWitt Clinton?" "Yes, sir." "Where are you headed?" the man asked. "The Yankees," Jack replied. "Good luck." The man shook his head and returned to his newspaper.
And you have another section?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm
okay.
Going to go.
Great,
a little bit.
Great. Okay.
Japan, June 1941. The Kanko 97 torpedo bombers skimmed over the top of Suruga Bay, perilously low, the formation so tight the wings of the plane seemed to touch. The sun was rising in the east, casting a shiny yellow glaze over the water. In the lead bomber, 21-year-old warrant officer Takeshi Maeda watched the instruments as the bomber descended to drop yet another test torpedo. In the middle seat of three, he checked and rechecked his gauges and looked at the water below. "Lower, Toki," he said into his headset. "Lower. 80 meters, sir."
You're listening to...
Plane bucked in the morning winds. Maeda searched for the wooden targets on the horizon. "Lower. 60 meters, Maeda-san. You are too low." The voice of Takara Kono, the pilot of the plane on his left wing, crackled through his headset. "It won't work." "Lower," Maeda said, "just a little lower. I can see the target." "I repeat, Maeda-san, it won't work. Pull up." "Steady, target's in range." The two planes spread across the water, close enough that the pilots could see the tension on each other's faces. Kono, navigator, frantically waved his head, hand, thumb up, urging Maeda to pull up. Now, Maeda said it, Steh shouted. A thin torpedo dropped from the bottom of the plane and splashed into the water. The pilot pulled the stick back, and the plane immediately climbed skyward, racing from the water. Maeda struggled to turn and watch the torpedo, his face pressed against the plexiglass canopy. Go, go, he said to himself. He could see the thin silver glint of the torpedo streaking through the water. Out loud, he said, it's working. 300 meters to target. Look, it's working. That's Mr. Maeda. Mm. On the shore of the bay, an 8-year-old boy watched the warplanes fly across the water. Hiroya Sagana lived with his family just a few hundred yards from the bay. He was fascinated with the airplanes that flew low over his home, the noise of the fast fighters, the sight of the dive bombers pulling out of their slow dives over the battleships astounded him. He was partial to the maneuvers of the Zero, the speedy, quick-maneuvering fighter planes, and spent many sleepless nights dreaming about what it'd be like to fly one someday. One morning, he asked his grandfather why so many planes were flying near their home, practicing. For what? They already know how to fly. Only the people in the government know what they are practicing, why they are practicing. Please do not ask me any more questions about that subject. Although he was only 8, Sugano knew that his country was at war in China. His father, a doctor, was called to serve in China in 1938, just as his father before him had served in World War I. Sugano saw the heroic banners and read the tales of glorious victories with great pride. That's Dr. Sugano. Not far away, Fukumatsu Ito toiled in the fields as the thunderous rains started to pour from the sky. Iconic Mount Fuji, often visible on clear days, was now completely obscured by clouds. It was the start of the June rains, the torrential storms that deluge Shizuoka every year and nourish the land. 49-year-old Fukumatsu raised soybeans on a large farm on the outskirts of the city near the Abe River. Ito was a master brewer of soy sauce and soy paste, and he sold his fresh products at a small grocery store near the farm. He had worked the land and created his sauces for 27 years, ever since his father, Taro, joined the Japanese Navy during World War I as an intelligence officer. Fukumatsu, then 22 and a senior at Aoyama University, received an exemption from service because he ran the family farm, a necessary occupation at the time. It seemed backwards to him. He should have been in service, and his father, 41, should have been managing the family farm. Mm-hmm. But Taro had an exceptional attitude for deciphering and creating coded messages and was pressed into service by his former college language professor, Seiichi Osada.
You know, at one point there, you were talking about when Jack went to flight school or pre-flight school, and he's learning to fly, and he was kind of...
I didn't understand you.
Oh, you were talking about, in the book, about when Jack went to flight school, and he was kind of a hot dog, and the the instructor said, there are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old, bold pilots.
That's correct. that's an old saying. I'll read a little bit more if I could. You want me to?
You bet.
On a steamy Washington, D.C. summer day, Secretary of State Cordell Hull strode into the lobby of the Hayes Adam, accompanied by 2 aides. He quickly looked around to see if he had been recognized, nodded to the concierge, and moved on to the elevator. On the 6th floor, he knocked on the door of a suite and was quickly ushered in and shown to the living area where straight-backed Japanese ambassador Kishibura Nomura stood waiting for him, looking uncomfortable in a formal back suit. Hull preferred the hotel over the State Department for these meetings, which were designated to find ways to diffuse the increasing tension between the two countries. Even within the State Department, few knew of the discussions which would have sparked debate throughout the world's diplomatic circles. Japan was already aligned with Germany and Italy, and many in Washington saw a need to talk to the savages wreaking havoc in the Far East. But Hull was convinced that it was important to talk to Nomura to keep the channels of communications alive.
Jerry, how did you decide which characters to focus on in telling the story?
Well, I couldn't do the 23. I reached the families of three, and I wanted to have a fourth one, and I chose the radar operator, Monroe Cohn. And I did that because he went to work for the Sarnoff family in RCA, creating radar, which is what they did, and I wanted to write about that. I met the Colley family, I met the Tal family, and Richard Fisk was pretty much a well-known character in Hawaii. He was the one who planted a rose once a month on the Arizona Memorial. I just have three paragraphs more I'd like to read, if I could, to introduce some of the other characters.
Go right ahead.
In rural Connecticut, 15-year-old Ken Colley, one of 11 children born to Jake and Sarah Colley, was about to make Eagle Scout. A Cub Scout since the age of 9, he loved the outdoors and took pride in scouting. He was a star in making fires with flint and steel. He felt exhilarated living in a one-man tent, cooking over a fire and tramping in the woods. A natural leader, he could navigate through the woods using a compass, confounding any scout leader who tried to purposely get the troop lost. In the summer of 1941, he was eagerly looking forward to attending an American Boy Scout Jamboree in Colorado, after the International Jamboree was called off due to the wars in Europe and Asia. In Portland, Maine, 19-year-old Newton Tal Jr. was starting a new life. 2 years earlier, over the angry objections of his parents, he had quit high school, taken a job at a local shipyard, and married his sweetheart, Florence. Everyone thought she was pregnant, but it wasn't true. A little more than a year later, though, she gave birth to a daughter, Lucretia, nicknamed Lucy. Newt, as he was known, spent his days pounding nails in the shipyard to make money to feed his new family. He was looking forward to the warm days of summer when he could hike and fish in the Maine woods. And on the distant island of Oahu in Hawaii, 19-year-old Richard Fisk was enjoying his new posting on the battleship West Virginia. For a Marine, it was good duty. He was assigned to be a lookout on the navigational bridge with a secondary post manning a machine gun turret on the deck. When the powerful ship was at sea, he had a perfect vantage point to watch the majestic firing of the big guns. He was not a sailor, didn't like the ocean, but he enjoyed the camaraderie on board, going about his job with his friends and crewmates. So there's pretty much the characters in the book.
Jerry, how long did it take you to research the historical events?
Well, it was interesting. My sister lives in New Jersey, and she knows a guy by the name of Paul Zigo, who was an assistant professor of history. And I didn't have a lot of ability to do research, so I wrote him an email and said, would any of his students would like to take on a project and do some research of what was going on politically between America and Japan in 1940, 1941? I wanted them to do that. I was going to research the American side. I was going to research the people. And I got an email back. He said, strange that you should ask. He said, my master's thesis from Tulane University was on the failed meeting between President Roosevelt and Prince.
Wow.
And so I said, well, could you send it to me, Paul? He says, absolutely. What are you going to do with it? I says, I'm writing a book, historical fiction. I started to write it out as history, but then I saw that couldn't work. So he sent me his thesis, and everything in the book that I write about, historically, about the meetings between the Japanese and the Americans, is absolutely factually true.
Mm.
Now, at that point in time, the Japanese appointed Yamamoto as the head of the operation of preparing for war in case Japan had to go to war. So I brought Yamamoto into it, and I brought Mr. Ito into it, the Fukamatsu's father, and I brought some characters in from San Francisco who were put in concentration camps, you know, the camps, the Japanese Americans were put in the camp. And just one thing led to the next. I mean, it just, I don't know where it came from, Monica. It just, the story evolved and evolved and evolved into what it is today.
Now, in this, you know, you go back and forth between the characters throughout the book, and also in time, because you write about things that happened after the war, as well as the things that, the incidents that,
yes,
and so forth. And one thing that I found really interesting was that many of the family members of these soldiers that were killed did not know for a long, long time what had happened to them.
No, they didn't know. They really didn't know for years. Really didn't know. And what they've told me that this has given them closing. George O'Connor was at the ceremony in 2008. He speaks in the video that was taken by the American Air Force photographers from Yokota Air Base who were there. And it's a very moving tribute to his family, and he just feels great about it. So do the other people. I find it very interesting in the comparisons of what Jack O'Connor and all of these guys were doing in 1941, looking forward to college, looking forward to a baseball career, looking forward to a life, and they were preparing for war in Japan. Same people, same age people. They were all preparing for war. And it's kind of an interesting comparison.
I also was really intrigued by that two of people who had a connection to this town that was firebombed and this event or this situation where a Japanese citizen created this memorial to the American B-29 crews that were killed during that firebombing raid. And there were two people who had a connection to that who met many, many, many years later, and just coincidentally.
No, in 1972... met Mr. Ito. Literally, he was taking a walk with his daughter, saw a sign pointing to the monument. He climbed the mountain with his daughter, found some people who were doing gardening, asked what this was about and who was doing it, and they directed him to Mr. Ito, who was then quite old.
Wow. And then there was another coincidence with Dr. Ken Yamakawa and Dr. Mary Saltzman in 1991?
They were invented.
Oh, they were invented. Okay. I thought that was... I thought, wow, that's really amazing.
But that's, you know, that's how the story...
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could have happened.
Now, Jerry, did you keep a journal during... when you were in World War II?
I didn't keep a journal. I didn't write. I wrote letters to my mother, and every letter that I wrote, she kept. And when she died in 1986, we're cleaning out her apartment, and my daughter-in-law found the letters and threw them away.
Oh no!
Every letter that I wrote, the entire war.
No.
Oh golly!
Is it ever
a daughter-in-law anymore?
Is it you disowned her?
No, not me.
Has it been difficult for you to relive those memories of that time, which you've had to do to write so convincingly?
I didn't have to go too deep within me to do what I did writing. But we were in Fairfield a few months ago, and a documentary maker from Kansas City came up to see me, because he wants to make a documentary about the Blackened Canteen. And after we talked about what he needed, he asked everybody to excuse themselves and put a big tape, and he says, I'm going to talk to you about personal things. I said, what kind of personal things? What you saw during the war. I says, Tom, I can't talk about that. And he said, look, World War II veterans, there are about 2 million of the 16 million who served, are still alive. They're leaving this world about 75 to 80,000 a month. If you don't record what you knew and what you saw, then it's going to be lost. So that put me into a different mindset, and I told him everything that I saw and everything that I did, everything that I hated about war and everything that I liked about war, the flying aspect of being a pilot, a fighter pilot. There are only 35 or 40,000 fighter pilots of the hundreds of thousands of pilots that graduated from flying school. We were given the best equipment that was ever made at the time and turned loose and freedom. And I was 19 years old when I graduated from flying school, 21 when the war was over. Unfortunately, I achieved some rank, but when I came home from the war as a captain and a squadron leader, I was still a 17-year-old high school graduate with 4 years of war experience and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to dig into that, and I did, and there's a tape on it. I haven't seen it, but yes, it was difficult, very difficult.
I bet. So you started writing The Blackened Canteen in 2006 after having attended the memorial.
Yes.
And how long did you have a particular writing routine? How long did the whole process take?
Well, when you're married and you're living with a wife for such a long time and you're used to having time together, I wrote mornings and spent the rest of the day with Helene. At the time, we had rented a summer cottage up in North Carolina, and I didn't want to leave her alone, and I enjoyed being with her. So I wrote mornings, and that's still my routine. I get up early and write for 3-4 hours, and that's the way I work.
Did you always want to be a writer?
I never knew about writing. I'm a good storyteller. I like to talk, and when I write, people tell me that I have a great style that's easy to read.
It is.
I write in pictures. I write what I see. I don't know where it comes from, Monica. I don't know where the dialogue comes from, but I see the scenes that I'm writing about, and the words describe the scenes and the people. Now, a lot of Jack, at 21 years old, when he goes to the prom, that was my prom. Mm-hmm. I was talking about me.
Right.
Tommy Dorsey at the Astor Roof, and dancing, and the songs and all of that. And going through flying school, which Newton Towle did, which Monroe did, which Jack O'Connor did, all of those experiences were my experiences. So that was easy.
Well, it's not easy to convey it as clearly as you do. Or maybe it is easy for you, but it's a gift.
It is. For some people, they know what they want to say, but they just can't get it down.
Yeah.
Now, well, I'm sort of led and guided by whoever leads and guides songwriters and artists. I've heard them describe the same feeling.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to mention the other Fairfield connection to this war memorial in Japan that you mention in your book, that your friend from Fairfield, Jim Belalove, designed a... well, why don't you tell us what he did?
I went to Jim Belalove from Creative Edge in November of 2007. And I said, Jim, I'm going to ask you to do something, and I'm going to tell you what it is. And I told him, I said, there's a place in Japan where there's a monument that a ceremony has been conducted since 1946 for 23 B-29 guys that were killed, and their names are not there, and I want to donate their names. He said, sounds interesting. I said, I don't have any money. Well, I'll do it. I said, I have to raise the money. He said, who asks you for money?
And it sounds
said,
like
well, what do you mean, who asks me for money? It has to be paid for. Why would you do it? And he said, Jerry, I want to do it to honor you and everybody that you flew with and fought with and everybody who served in World War II, which gave me the opportunity to do what I wanted to do in life.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what he said to me.
Wow.
At the time, he pulled me over to the side in his office, and he said, see this? And I looked at a piece of marble with a picture of a Marine on it and writing and dates, He says, anybody from Iraq, any family that contacts me and gives me the details, I make this memorial shrine for them to have in their house, and I don't charge them anything. Nobody knows this about Jim. You know, I'm telling stories now. and that's what he did.
Wow.
He came to Japan with Ginger, and I think if you ask him, he said he had the most fascinating week of his entire life.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to talk to him about that.
It's at the ceremony and at the unveiling.
Yeah.
Again, you can see it at www.jerryyellen.com. You can see the whole thing, including the monument.
And the Blackened Canteen is available on your website also?
The Blackened Canteen, you can click and go right to Amazon.com.
And, of course, we also like to support our local bookstores who can either have it or
I'm not sure that
it.
The 20th Century has it. I would advise them to get it. They can order it from First World Publishing in Fairfield, Ed Spinella and Rodney Charles.
Great.
And put it in the store.
And we're just about out of time, but I have one quick question. How did you get Yoko Ono to write a blurb for your book?
She had a double truck ad with one word in it in the New York Times called Peace.
Mm.
And I answered that ad with a story. If you go to imaginepeace.com, one word, /jerryyellen.html, you'll see what I wrote to her. And she responded.
Wow.
And this is the way she responded when I asked her, when I told her about the ceremony, would she give me a press release? And so she wrote that press release and gave it to me.
That's very, very fitting for this wonderful book. Well, thank you for being with us today. You've been listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today has been Jerry Yellen. If you're listening on Friday, stay tuned for Planet Earthwild with James Moore. He is going to be interviewing Wasilla, Alaska native Ann Kilkenny this afternoon at 4 p.m. She's the one whose email made it all around the about Sarah Palin made it all around the world, and she's been interviewed quite extensively, and now she'll be here with James. And let's see, what else do we have? Oh, one of our former guests, Freddie Fonseca, who does the poetry readings, they're doing Poems from the Zoo this evening at Revelations at 8 p.m. He's with Raven Garland, Ed Noyes, and Melinda Waters. So hopefully we can turn out for that. And we'll close with a quote from Mom.
Okay, this is Thomas Edison once said, I am proud that I never invented anything that would be used to kill people.
Thanks for listening to Writer's Voices, and see you next week.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.